I think this is the most important thing going on in this world at this time. Not this lecture in particular, but this endeavor of which this discussion is part. I'm an American. You ask any American what happened in 1492, say Columbus made his voyage, and that is correct. But there's a lot of other things that happened in 1492. In 1492, England and France signed a peace treaty. In 1492, the Borgias took over the papacy. In 1492, Lorenzo de' Medici died. Okay, lots of things. And especially the Borgias taking over the papacy. If they had had newspapers in 1492, that would have been the big headlines. Okay, not, you know, that some Genoese weaver's son got some boats and went off in some direction that nobody with a right mind would ever go and you know, found some islands inhabited by savages or something. I mean, and yet that's what is remembered. What are people going to remember 500 years from now? Are they going to remember which group of fanatics came out on top in Syria? Or who got in or who got out in the latest government scandal and overthrow, or whatever? No, they won't care about that stuff. They won't even know about that stuff. But what those people living not only on Mars, but on hundreds of planets orbiting stars in this neck of the galaxy are going to think about when they think about this time, is they're going to remember this time because this is when people first set sail for other worlds. This is the enduring achievement of our age if we can pull it off. And so, thanks for wanting to get involved in it. Now, as you have seen, I don't speak the native language. But I'm learning it, so I'll try to use a few expressions to be comprehensible, which will probably be inappropriate. But anyway, let's get a wriggle on. And start talking about the subject at hand, which is humans to Mars within a decade. I'm going to talk at some length on how I think that could be done. Perhaps I'll talk a little bit about why I think it needs to be done in such a time frame if it is to be done. And a little bit about why I think it needs to be done, period. That's an awful lot to talk about in a talk of an hour. I won't be able to cover it all adequately, or frankly any of it adequately, but as Guy pointed out, I have written a book on the subject, which unfortunately we sold out of all the copies that I brought at the previous talks, but it's still available on Amazon, in print, in Kindle. If you think what I have to say is interesting, get it. And if you think what I have to say is important, join the Mars Society Australia. Okay, so, humans to Mars within a decade. How can anybody propose such a thing? Okay, those of you who have followed this subject for a while have no doubt seen many concepts of this sort as how we're supposed to go to Mars. This is a current NASA concept for the first human mission to Mars. Okay, it involves a gigantic interplanetary spaceship. I call it the Death Star. It's very large. You can see Mars is here for scale. It's gigantic, nuclear-powered, ion drive or plasma drive or whatever. And, I mean, it should be self-evident that if this is what is required to go to Mars, we're not going to Mars in 10 years. And, in fact, you're not going to Mars ever because nothing like this would ever be built until we have a mature interplanetary civilization that would desire such artifacts and be capable of building them, okay? But this is not what is required to go to Mars. This is what is required if you want to have a science fiction movie about going to Mars with impressive computer animated special effects. But it's not what's needed. What is needed? Well, It's to answer that question that a group of engineers, led by me and another fellow named David Baker, set about designing the Mars Direct plan. And the name Mars Direct is suggestive both of the actual flight mode suggested in the plan, but also programmatically. That is, it's direct punch. It does not involve any diversions. The thing was provoked by, you see, in 1989, the first President Bush got up in front of the Air and Space Museum in Washington, D.C., flanked by Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin and Michael Collins, the Apollo 11 crew, and he said, "This is the 25th anniversary of the Apollo moon landing. That was great. That's what America's all about. And therefore, I, as President, am committing us to go back to the moon and on to Mars, and this time to stay." It's great stuff. So NASA went off nominally to devise a plan on how this could be carried out. But what they really were doing was devising a plan on how they could make use of this presidential imperative to justify the complete assortment of technology programs that they wanted to get funded. So they designed the most complex Mars initiative you could possibly imagine, involving orbital bases, lunar bases, this, that. Okay, all this stuff that you didn't really need in order, in other words, and that pretty much killed the program right there, with a massive cost estimate, $400 billion, a huge timeline. But really, they were not developing a plan to get to Mars. They were developing a plan to make use of the fact that somebody else wanted to get to Mars to sell what they had to sell. And this is the exact opposite of the correct way to do engineering. You don't do an engineering project in order to spend money to fund a lot of people. Okay, that's like running your company in order to fund your vendors. Okay, you, if you're running a company, you may need vendors, you probably do, but you want to use the fewest of them you can and pay them as little as possible. Okay, whereas they were going the other way. So what is the sound way to go about designing a Mars mission with as few vendors as possible? Okay. Now, by the way, I want to talk about that. So any space plan requires an appropriate launch vehicle. And in order to keep the number of launches down to a minimum, we decided we wanted to have a launch vehicle with equivalent capability to the Saturn V that we used to go to the moon during the Apollo program. And because the Nixon administration, in its infinite wisdom, had scrapped the assembly line of the Saturn V and, in fact, given the blueprints to the Boy Scout paper drive in Huntsville, Alabama, that's true. I'm not making this up. We designed a heavy lift vehicle to be built out of shuttle hardware. Okay? So this is the vehicle we designed. We call it the Ares after the Greek name for Mars. And so it's pretty fairly straightforward. External tank, shuttle external tank without the ogive, which is the pointy top. We don't need that. Couple of solids. They're in current manufacture. And then a pod of four space shuttle main engines, which were offset thus, because at the time this was designed, the shuttle was still flying, and we wanted to use the shuttle launch pads, which have their flame trenches positioned here. Now, the shuttle's no longer flying, so if you were to develop a vehicle like this, you would no longer do this. You'd just put the engines directly underneath, and it would improve performance a little bit. Well, what could the vehicle... Oh, and one more thing. The vehicle has an upper stage, which is hydrogen-oxygen propulsion, with 250,000 pounds of thrust, a million newtons, which is the same amount of thrust as you had in the J2 engine that powered the upper stages of the Saturn V. So that's, it's technology that we have. And then on top of it is a fairing 10 meters in diameter, or 33 feet if you work at Lockheed Martin. So it's quite capacious, can hold big payloads. Now people ordinarily rate launch vehicles by what they can lift to low Earth orbit, LEO, LEO. And if you want to know, Ares could lift 120 metric tons. Now that is a lot. It's a lot more than Shuttle could lift 20. Ariane 5 can lift 20. Proton can lift 20. Titan IV, which was flying at that time, could lift 20. This is 120, six times as much. So that might seem humongous. On the other hand, it's not unprecedented at all. Saturn V could do 140. Sort of amazing. You think about the space program as pushing the frontier of technology, and in a certain way it does, but, or it did. We in the space program today have, in a number of important respects, less capability than we had 45 years ago. We're kind of like people living in Italy around the year 800 AD, that is about a few hundred years after the fall of the Roman Empire, but all the impressive ruins are still around for viewing, and the giant colosseums and temples and aqueducts and so forth. And you're wandering around looking at this stuff and saying, we once built that? How could anybody have built that? No one could build that. And yet there it is. So you could develop a vehicle like this for sure, because we once did. Now,